Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz. You're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. Today's show is a highlights package of the year that has passed, so we'll be hearing lots of voices from across the shows to give you a little flavour of what has been and then some hints of what's to come next year. And we're going to start, as ever, with a song, and it's going to be Etta James' I Would Rather Go Blind.
Something told me it was over. Yeah. When I saw you and her talking, something deep down in my soul said, cry, girl.
That was Etta James and I'd Rather Go Blind. So today's show is just a little roundup of the year that we've had. It is in no way a popularity contest. So any of those that have not featured, it is not that I didn't love them wholly with my whole heart. It's just that these six pieces that are coming up just give a flavour and give a nice broad overview of what we've heard this year. So first up, cast your mind back to when it was sunny, warm, long, drawn-out, wonderful evenings where you could go out at 8 o'clock in the evening and it would be daylight and perhaps you were wearing a short. And you could see swifts through the skies, if you were lucky. So I wanted to go and catch up with the Hanover branch here in Brighton of the RSPB Swift Watch to see what it was exactly that they did and why it's such an important piece of work and the value of what they were doing. So I had first up a chat with Rebecca, who told us more about what it was that they did, and then later on you hear from Catherine. Here's Rebecca.
Our swifts come from the Congo Basin, so they have a pretty long road. They come later than swallows and other birds, so they have to get on with it pretty quickly and get their juveniles fledged and off again and back to the Congo 12 weeks later. So we have a really short time frame to monitor them. Brighton being a real hotspot for swifts, and that's why the RSPB really promote the work that people like us do and increasing their volunteer base so that we can both monitor where swifts are so we can try and protect their sites, and we can also encourage people locally to make some small adjustments to their properties, for example, to protect swifts. A key factor that we can influence in the UK is trying to protect nest sites and also encouraging swifts to nest in swift nest boxes. And that's a key part of what we do and what we're doing out tonight. Swifts can't just go and make another cut, like another nest. They're incredibly, incredibly loyal to their nest site and will try and endeavour to get back in there, even bashing their heads where the hole was, to try and break through to that nest site. You can move a nest site slightly, and again, you can't be guaranteed that you'll get the swift. So that's why it's so important that we create new nesting opportunities for swifts. And what we're doing out tonight, if we get to talk to people, we'll be talking to them about putting swift nest boxes up. They're incredibly efficient, incredibly inexpensive, anything from around £16. And they're something that we know works. So that's a key thing that we do, particularly when people have scaffolding ups again this time of year. We have to work quickly to contact people, to talk to them, to say, look, you've got scaffolding up. This is a fantastic opportunity. Get online, get yourself a swift nest box and get it up. And obviously, we are here to guide people and help them with any ideas about where's the best place to put swift boxes.
So my name's Catherine. This is my first year as a volunteer with the RSPB. It's something really that I've always wanted to do since I was a kid. Been fascinated by birds. always spending time in my garden working out what the different types of species they are, and it's something that's kept with me my whole sort of up until sort of being an adult. So always wanted to be either volunteer or work for the RSPB, and now that I'm in Brighton, where there's quite a big sense of community, I went on the website and came across this opportunity with supporting the local Swift. So it's been absolutely fantastic and really enjoying it.
What have you learned from doing it?
So I've learned, obviously, I mean, when I first looked on the website, going particularly looking for work specifically for Swifts wasn't necessarily something I was looking for. But as a result, I've just learned a huge amount about the type of bird they are, almost the characteristics, almost like their personality. And working with Rebecca and Jiva has been really fascinating, just to learn about not just the birds, but the different types of birds. When you're walking around and they've got all these facts about other species. And the biggest thing I've learned really is how supportive all the community are and how interested they all are in learning more and what they can do to support them. And when you start talking about the different putting up bird boxes, etc., their eyes light up. So it's been fantastic from that point of view.
Would people even know that they were nesting in the roof if they didn't know? You know, can you hear them? Are they noisy?
I mean, they are quite noisy people. One of the biggest things, I mean, you can hear them. They've got that sort of characteristic sort of screech as they're sort of flying in, but they're very clean birds. Mm. So it's sort of in comparison to starlings, for example, who are quite messy birds, they're so clean that you wouldn't necessarily even know that they existed,
yeah.
Which is one of the difficulties as well. So you may not know. And I have to say, even from my own perspective and being a bird lover myself, I don't look up into the eaves and have a look underneath the guttering and the fascias of houses and look for swift boxes, but I do obviously now. Mm. And even from just speaking to a few people, friends, etc., they're all saying, oh, my landlord's got scaffolding up and I'll help out in any way I can. So, and then when you talk about them in swifts, and they do know the type of bird, it's just they don't know a huge amount about them. Quite often there'll be like a group of maybe up to sort of 15, 16 swifts, I think we've counted in the past.
Cool. That's a lovely number up there.
Yeah.
There's quite a few. They come and go. It's almost like they just appear and reappear. But that must be 2, 4, 6, 8. See, they've disappeared again. I've just counted about 12 just now, and then there's 6.
A little taster of the swift piece there. It's such good work that they do, these volunteers, helping out in their own time, noticing and caring about what's going on in our skies. And I think that's such a real theme for a lot of things that popped up across the year, was just we need to put in a bit more effort to look after the other creatures that inhabit this planet. And that leads nicely into my next piece, which is from the Walk for Wildlife that happened in September. It was organised by Chris Packham, and he got together all of the influential people he knew in this realm, and he made roles for them called ministers. He kind of made up an alternative cabinet, and who would be in that and what would they represent if the cabinet was entirely just for wildlife. So in the show that went out, I spoke to George Monbiot, Kate Bradbury, and a few other voices, and Robert McFarlane was one of them. He is a great lover of nature and the outdoors. So this is a little chat I had with Robert just backstage at that event, and it was a little bit noisy in the background, but it all added to the atmosphere. Here's Robert.
I wrote a book called The Lost Words a year ago, and that was an attempt to bring the very basic language of and literacy of nature back into primary education, back into children's mouths and minds and stories and schools and libraries. And that has succeeded in a way that I could never have dreamed of. So I've learned a lot from that year about how things move through culture. In the manifesto, 10 points, the first point is the big one, rewrite section 78 of the Education Act. The Education Act, so that's the section which tells us the core curricular values of state education in this country. And the emphasis is quite rightly on the spiritual, moral and ethical development of the young people who pass through our education system. But it says nothing about the natural world. It says nothing about our position as part of that natural world, and also that it's absolutely crucial state for our future, but also for the well-being of people. And I strongly believe that what is good for nature, broadly speaking, is good for children, and what is good for children is, broadly speaking, good for nature. They play better, they think better, they talk better, they socialise better, they become better citizens, if we want to use that word, when they're thinking about and in nature.
It's vital that we engage kids in. And I think the loudest cheer here when Chris was going through the age groups,
yes,
was about 50.
Yeah.
You know, that's
yes,
the main. And yeah, so that's what we've got to really concentrate on, is thinking, well, how do we engage the younger people?
It is, because actually, in as it were, natural time, in tree time, the children are going to be growing up very, very fast. You know, it's great to see so many children here. I mean, that's been one of the wonderful, wonderful things. There are young people everywhere. But it's hard, you know. I work with a trustee of a charity called Action for Conservation, and Action for Conservation works with 12 to 18 year olds. We spend a lot of time thinking about, as a society, thinking about sort of 3 to 11 year olds, but then we sort of forget that the really hard years, the years when we really want people to keep remembering about nature's centrality to all of this, is actually 12 to 18, when booze and exams and partners, you know, suddenly enter life and hormones are raging and all the rest of it, and that's the time when it becomes easy to forget, totally understandably, no one's fault. So we do a lot of work with that age group, and then just things like the intersection of public health and natural well-being as well. You know, we're dealing with an obesity crisis, we're dealing with more time being spent inside. This notorious survey which suggested that British children spend less time outside than British prisoners, which is quite a stat, isn't it? It's an hour a day is the prison allowance, as it were, to be outside, and actually it makes perfect sense that children should not spend an hour outside on a school day and school week in Britain. So, but of course we live interior lives, the outside in all its complexities and beauties fades.
Yeah, well said. And with this, so it's a march on Parliament, it's quite a radical move. What are you hoping it will achieve? And is this very much just phase one?
Yeah, it's phase one. What do we hope it will achieve? It is a radical move. The document will not be agreed with by everyone. There are 200 ideas in that manifesto, and we want more. We want people who are listening to this programme, people who are here today, we want them to send their ideas in for change. How can we make change happen? Caring is not enough any longer. The situation is serious. So, yes, that's what we want. We want more ideas. We want to give this purchase on power. That's the really difficult bit. I think we have a bunch of brilliant ideas here, some of which are really low-hanging fruit. They could happen now, tomorrow, next month, and make really serious difference in terms of biodiversity, in terms of nature in this country. But how do we give them bite? Well, we hope Michael Gove will meet us. We'll meet Chris. We'll meet some of the young people here. I think Michael Gove is an environment is probably the most hopeful environment secretary we've had in my adult lifetime.
Surprising,
right? But he's doing
good stuff.
He's doing good stuff. A lot of it is not quite getting delivered as it should, but I genuinely
believe
he's thinking, he's talking, he can see a lot of the right things, and that's really hopeful. So I think we're at a position of extreme danger and a position of considerable hope, and that's an interesting political moment to be in.
The question I know you get asked the most: what can we do?
I've just been talking about
that. Yeah,
I think we have done what we can do to this point. I mean, I think there is this huge appetite for change, and to this point, in my own heart as well as in the hearts of many people I talk to, that energy has needed a direction. It's needed a very specific set of proposals for change, and we've begun that with this draft one of the manifesto, 200 ideas, and now we want another 200 after that. We want them to come in. So the ideas are there, the energy is there, the hope is there, and now we need to organise it and make change happen.
That was very much a theme from that event, actually. It was just that the smaller acts are all well and good because it engages people into nature and into caring about nature, and therefore people will help what they care about. But also just needing a bit more now, just needing a bigger push, needing to get a little bit more urgency around what's happening, especially with that big paper that was released about saying, you know, we've got 12 years to turn this around now, and that is not much time. So you can catch up with all of the other people from that event on the September issue called wildlife. Okay, let's have a song and then we'll be back with a revisit to Plot 22. But first, this is Willie Mason and We Can Be Strong.
Can't sell me tomorrow. We can be strong, strong, strong. We can be strong, strong, strong. Now I'm back on Mama's couch. Plenty of time to think about.
It's Willie Mason and We Can Be Strong. So next we're going to revisit Plot 22, and I went along to the Dementia Inclusive Gardening Group. This is absolutely one of my favourite things of the year. I just loved it. To see the value of being outside, of engaging with the garden, with the space, and just to see how helpful it was for everybody that was there, those living with dementia and those caring for those living with dementia. It was quite emotional. It was quite a powerful thing. So I wanted to just nip back there and give a little a shortened version, a little highlight, sure, of what that group was all about. So we're going to hear first from Charlotte Overton Hart, who facilitates the group.
Joy, how do you feel today?
All the better for seeing you.
Thank you.
All of you. And the baby. Sitting there like a little love.
My name's Charlotte. I support people who are living with dementia and their carers to help them have meaningful moments and moments of connection.
What makes a space dementia friendly?
We always start with the person, their strengths, things that they love to do, and then alongside that we consider what people might find tricky. So for example, if someone's mobility is not quite so good, which may or may not be dementia related, or if because of the type of a person's dementia they have problems with their perception or sequencing, we then think how that might present a challenge in the space. So many people who are living with dementia wouldn't find a garden space challenging at all, and if anything it's more relaxing and restful than being indoors, just listening to the birds and seeing the trees and noticing the seasons. So much of these things are beyond language, so they don't present the challenges that an indoor environment might. The value really is in being with one another and enjoying unhurried quality time, and that really is the starting point and the basis from everything.
Do you find that participants tend to be people that have been keen gardeners previously? You know, is there a retained knowledge in there that, or do you get people who've never really had much to do with gardening come along as well?
Yeah, typically the participants who come along are keen gardeners or have been in the past.
Okay.
That's absolutely not a requirement on our side, but certainly I have been learning from the participants names of plants and flowers. My own background is not in gardening, and I couldn't pretend it was, because I just don't know the things that our participants know. I remember pottering along with one of our participants and she said to me, "Oh, what's that called?" pointing at a very pretty blue flower, and I said, "Oh, I don't know, I wonder what it is called." And it came back to her and she said, "I know, it's love in the mist." And I've remembered that. It's a real treat to spend time with people who have sometimes still very strong memories for the gardening they've done throughout their lives.
Are we planting these or just going for beetroot?
Through the beetroot for now, shall we?
Yeah, so we don't get into...
Isn't it early for beetroot? Yes. I was just looking. It's 1 month early, I think. Should be done.
What are we doing?
Beetroot.
Right, let's go with beetroot, friends. OK, are these ones OK?
Yeah. I think, yeah.
Okay, great.
They'll get planted out when they start.
Step two. So
bring it back again.
Joy, would you like to have a go?
Who are we? Yeah.
Well, my name's Ray Buckley, and my sister has Alzheimer's, and I'm a full-time carer for her. It does them a lot of good. Get them out. And Joy doesn't do a lot of walking, which means her legs aren't going so well now either. So it's very difficult. But the group helps. And I'm doing all right at the moment, and I managed to support her.
How long has she been living with Alzheimer's?
4 years.
Okay.
Maybe a bit more. That was diagnosis. So maybe a bit more. It's gradually getting worse.
Yeah.
Now she'll forget where the light switch is. We'll forget how to turn the television on. So I have to do all that. I do all the cooking, all the washing. So, yeah, I'm having to cope with more and more and more. But we're doing it. And trying to get up here as well.
Does it feel like a bit of respite for you as well, being here?
Yeah, because I'm not full bore doing something else.
Does Joy remember coming here? Does she take some of it with her after you leave?
No, if I mention it tomorrow, she won't remember it. She might remember it when halfway through the week, all of a sudden, something had come back to her. But otherwise, no.
So it's just about being quite present then? It's just
everything is in the present, yeah. You live for the moment, absolutely.
Do you think it's chimes? I'm here with my dad. He got diagnosed just over a year ago. They thought he had Alzheimer's at first, but they recently changed his diagnosis to Lewy body dementia.
Okay, what does that mean?
As far as I understand, it's a dementia often comes with Parkinson's, and dad gets his perspective is a bit warped, so it warps his perspective and can come with anxiety, depression, and the other one, hallucinations.
How do you find bringing him to things like this?
It really helps. He loves, because he can get quite lonely, even though we'll see him regularly, to have a new experience initially will cause anxiety, but actually is more positive in the long run once we've got through the actually arriving and meeting people.
Has he had experience of gardening before? Is that why you brought him here?
Yes. Okay. He has gardened his whole life. He and my mum had a great garden which they transformed. Yeah. He worked really hard at it. Just saying about your garden, Dad.
Hello, Hatchmere. I hear you've been a keen gardener.
So we had 5 acres of ground.
Five acres?
It was fun at first. My son used to help on that. And how long have we lived there? 7 years. Last year I started feeling it was a chore, but after then I liked it as something to do. And I had a deal with my son, he cut the lawns, he got 50p a lawn.
50p a lawn? That sounds a little bit low.
Cut that bit from the end. I have to go back to the
activity. Okay, back to your beetroot. Cheers. Thanks for coming over. It's a very sensitive question, but how is it for you living, you know, your dad having dementia? And
It's quite emotional.
Yeah.
So I think the uncertainty is emotional. On a day-to-day basis, he seems to manage to function quite well. He's done amazingly well, actually, transitioning to living on his own. But then he'll all of a sudden sort of decline a bit and not cope so well, get depressed or anxious. And I think it's just really emotional thinking what's going to happen in the future, because we don't really know how quickly it will happen, or whether it'll be years or decades. I didn't think that Dad would be up for trying these new things, but he really thrives. He really thrives when he's at some of these sessions.
Do you think there's anything about gardening particularly that is helpful?
I think it's a sensory thing, isn't it? It makes you feel alive and that you're seeing things growing, and makes you feel just happy and fulfilled, I think.
It was just a few of the voices from that group. As with many things like that, it's so unfortunate that they just struggle with having enough funding. And that is something that just comes through so many of the people I meet and so many of the groups that I get to go along to. It's just that they just have to fight so hard to be funded. So if anyone listening does feel like they would like to chuck a few quid at some of these projects, then get in touch. I will give you all of those methods to do so at the end of the show, or search for them online. It's the Dementia Inclusive Gardening Group at Plot 22. You can very much find them online. It's a wonderful thing. Okay, next we're going to move along to Steve Lane. Now, he featured on the pilgrimage episode. It was a little bit different, that episode. It was just sort of four stories of people's experience of pilgrimage. It was it was something that I got interested in, and having this vehicle, having this show is quite, it's quite helpful really. It just means I get to go and speak to people who can fulfill my queries really. It's like, oh, I'm a bit interested in that. Oh great, I can go and speak to that person about it. So Steve completed the Camino de Santiago a few years back, which is a trail that runs through the whole of northern Spain. And you start in the Pyrenees and you end up right on the coast. It's quite a trek. It takes a very long time. This was just one of the experiences from that show. And the longer versions, I'm going to say this about every one of these, I think, but the longer versions really are better. But this is a taster. This is a slightly shortened version of Steve's experience of what just walking, the simple act of walking, and what that brought to him and how that actually quite profoundly changed his life.
So at the time I was working in London, and I was basically just really, really unhappy, and quite a chaotic lifestyle, and generally feeling a bit kind of lost, I suppose. And I was wanting to quit my job. I knew I'd had to have some time in between. Wanted to take, I was thinking about doing some sort of travelling just to kind of have a break. There was an advert in the paper for the Camino, so I kind of saw it and a light bulb went off, and then that's where the idea, I think, kind of came from. And in that time in between, after seeing the advert, there were a few moments, I suppose, where the pull of doing the walk kind of got to me a bit more. It's that thing where it felt like a kind of a calling to do it, really. Not in a particularly religious sense, in how most people might understand it, I don't know. So some of the backstory of how I heard about the walk, there was a book called The Alchemist that I read. If you haven't read it, then read it. But it's a lot of it is about kind of seeing signs that life presents you and then following them, so kind of following your heart really. And symbols, so kind of things from nature or people that come into your life, and if you recognise it, they can offer you messages about things that might kind of help you in your life journey. So there was that, and then another book by the same author is called The Pilgrimage, and it's about the walk, about this Camino de Santiago. So I think I'd read both books by then, certainly The Alchemist. So I saw this advert, and then part of me kind of thought, oh wow, Santiago, the guy in the book's called Santiago, and maybe this is a sign. And then, maybe it was a few days later, I was thinking about, should I do this walk? And then there was a knock at the door in the office that I worked in, is in kind of Old Street, central London, kind of hipsterville. I opened the door and there was a nun standing at the door. And I'd never seen a nun in that part of London, and she kind of opened the door at the moment that I was thinking about doing this kind of Catholic pilgrimage.
Oh, I got goosebumps.
Yeah, and I kind of thought, oh.
And did you approach it thinking that it was a pilgrimage? Did you research anything into that word and that connotation? Because it's a weighty word for somebody who says doesn't come from a religious background or have that desire.
Yeah.
To say or to use the word pilgrimage, it does carry a lot of weight. So
I hadn't explicitly researched it, and particularly the word pilgrimage, I hadn't sort of looked it up. But I think that there was something about it. I mean, the metaphor is just too obvious that, I felt like I had lost my way and my life didn't have a direction. And the one thing that a pilgrimage offers you is a clear path and a direction. So, as a metaphor for what I needed at that time. Well, I think I was approaching it as a pilgrimage, even if at the time I wouldn't have called it that.
And what happened to you or for you on throughout the walk? Did you arrive? It all seems a bit neat, doesn't it, to think, well, I'm going to go on this because I've lost my way, and then by the end of it, I will know exactly what I want in life, and everything's going to be dreamy, and not necessarily so, but what was your experience?
I think that was probably, you probably described what my wish was quite nicely. That kind of thought, right, well, I'll do this thing, come back and everything will be sorted and I'll be fine, and I can, life will be a piece of cake after that. It's kind of, on one hand, it's kind of true, and on the other hand, it's not at all. When I was doing the walk, I think I realised a lot of things about myself, and I suppose by that I mean, it, as examples would be that I think I'm more capable than I thought I was at the start. So, you know, so I remember arriving in, I think it was San Sebastian or somewhere like that, and I remember being in this hostel somewhere and like wanting to cry and wanting to go home, like thinking, I can't do this, what am I doing? And kind of catastrophizing, like, oh my God, I have to go home, all these people, I've told them to do it, they're going to think I'm a failure, you know, all this stuff. And really, like, panicking, and then waking up in the morning and thinking, right, well, just got to do it. And there were various points along the way where, you know, kind of like my knee went for a few days, like really, really painful, and the blisters were just like insane. So there were moments of real pain, actually, where I thought I couldn't take another step, or kind of couldn't carry on. Mm. And it was quite moving thinking about it, actually. So kind of thinking that I couldn't do it and then realising that I could, I think, you know, it just represented something really deep inside in terms of my own capacity and determination and courage. So I think for those kind of, you know, recognising some of my qualities, I think it really changed things, which carried on. So, like, it's like I had a direction, and I could kind of... And because it's moving, because I was actually physically moving in a very simple way, I think that then help me move stuff internally. It's like, all I've got to do is move. All I've got to do is put one foot in front of another and keep doing that, and then trust that. Mm-hmm. And then I think in that process, in that kind of cycling, and in the turmoil that's kind of turning inside me, it sort of spun out and became a bit clearer. Mm-hmm. In that moment. So no, I didn't know what to do with it, but the walking really helped.
Right. One, like, you can always do one more step.
That was exactly it, and I think that was kind of probably the biggest. And again, it's such a simple thing, you know, because there were, you know, there were those days where, so like coming down from the Pyrenees, down from the mountains, like walking downhill is really hard going, and my knee was in absolute agony, so it was maybe like 4 or 5 days of just like a couple of days where I was basically dragging my leg because it was just really painful. And it's like, well, what are you going to do? Stay in some hut in the middle of the mountains, a comfortable hut, but you know, or walk on to the next town and get some water. Mm. So it's like, well, you just have to. So in dragging myself, all I could say to myself was, I can take one more step. You know, if I was to think, but it's, you know, 15 miles away, I wouldn't do it. Mm. But if I thought, well, I know I can take one more step. So that became like a mantra, I suppose, going through, was one more step, one more step.
That was Steve Lane from the pilgrimage episode. For me, what came from that episode was, you know, we all know we're just surrounded by noise and by shouting and by people just like, being outraged by things all the time. And there's just a lot of tension and activity. And hearing each of the people that featured on that show just taking that time out, just removing themselves from that situation. And in whichever form it took, I appreciate not everyone can go for a month-long walk or, you know, whatever. But the essence of all of them was just about taking a step back and getting a bit closer to yourself and to the simplicity of just being outside and of listening and of the motion of movement. And it's very gentle. And each of the voices, each of the four people who featured on that show just seemed to gain so much just from taking that time, just from stepping back and just breathing and just doing such a simple task. So if you want to listen to any of these shows that I'm talking about, then you can find them all. They're all available as podcasts, and you can find them on the website, which is radioreverb.com. If you go /, and shows, and search for Growing Wild, then there will be links there, or alternatively just search for them all on iTunes, Spotify, or any of those podcast providers. Okay, we're going to have a song, and then we're going to come back to the final part of the show with two more highlights. But first, let's But first we're going to have Francesca Blanchard with Free.
Find me a place in the ocean where time and space on an ocean so dark and quiet. So dark and quiet, you seem so free. You seem so free.
That was Free by Francesca Blanchard. You're listening to Radio Reverb. This is Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz, and you're tuned in to 97.2 FM, or you might be listening online, or perhaps digitally. The next highlight I'm going to share with you is the wonder of Anne Thwaite. She's a bit of a human dynamo. She does so many different things. She's involved with numerous social enterprises across the county. And this one that I caught up with her about was about seaweed. It's a bit of a wonder product, is seaweed, and I hadn't realised quite to what extent it was until I caught the infectious enthusiasm of Anne. So this was us on Worthing Beach, again when it was warm and sunny, and we were paddling through at a low tide, the sandy beach. It was absolutely delightful. Until I thought my shoes had been stolen at the end, which thankfully they hadn't. So this is Anne telling us more about seaweed and why we should probably just pay it a little bit more attention.
So we have hundreds of different species of seaweed all along the British coastline, most of whom are edible. Now, edible is always subject to a bit of caution because seaweed is a natural filter feeder, so it cleans the water and it takes up the pollutants. So depending on the pollution levels of the water that the seaweed grows in, it's more or less edible. But there are a number of businesses now all along the British coastline, specifically actually in Cornwall and in Scotland, who have started hand harvesting seaweed and who are selling it for food purposes, so you can eat it. The one thing that you can, there's actually many more uses for seaweed, so not just for food, so you can use it as a fertilizer. So there's a seaweed production that's meant for plant fertilizer. You can use it much more commonly in cosmetics. So you will find more and more products at the moment that have seaweed as a cosmetic ingredient. And you can also use it as a plastic replacement.
A plastic replacement?
Yes.
How so?
So seaweed is there's a particular type of seaweed that is quite sturdy, and I've previously seen ways of turning this material into almost like a film, and so you can form it to turn it into plastic bottles, for example, or plastic replacement bottles, fill it with water, and then once you've drunk the water, the seaweed basically just shrinks back into itself when it decomposes.
Wow.
It's very experimental, but they definitely are working on using seaweed as all sorts of ways to see whether we can replace plastic with seaweed materials.
So it's a wonder product.
It is a wonder product. And the most amazing thing about it is that seaweed has been on this planet for much, much longer than any land plant. And the one of the seaweed species is the second fastest growing plant on the planet. So if we were to cultivate seaweed, which is actually something that the UK government recommends, then we could grow seaweed in large quantities very quickly, and therefore sustainably work in the marine environment using a material that's completely harmless to the environment. In fact, it actually aids the marine environment.
Amazing.
And and that can potentially help us in all sorts of ways with our health, because seaweed is extremely nutritious if you use it as a food source, or, for example, helping us fight plastic pollution.
I would love to be able to eat the seaweed that I find on the coast near where I live, which is the south coast, southeast coast. but because of the unknown levels of pollution in the water, I wouldn't feel safe eating seaweed straight off the beach here, whereas I know if you go sort of to Dorset down, that's quite safe. So how do we firstly find out what the level of pollution in the water is, and then secondly, is there anything that we can do to lobby somebody somewhere to, because this just seems crazy that this is a huge food source here that could be being utilised, or in many different facets, like you mentioned. That feels like that's a really good incentive to clean up the waters.
I think there's several things that need to be done. I think one is, I think the general population, especially here in West Sussex where we are, has a historically quite negative relationship with seaweed, so they don't really see this as a benefit. Having seaweed on the beach does not count as a reason why you would want to come to the beach. In fact, it has kept a lot of people off the beach. But
why is that?
So Worthing in particular used to get tons and tons of seaweed washed up on the beach, especially after big storms. And so what happened was all of the seaweed washed up on the beach, it started rotting on the beach. There was also raw sewage going in at the time. So you can imagine rotting seaweed with raw sewage mixed in the summer months when it's really hot basically created a stench that was unbelievable for inhabitants and visitors to Worthing alike. So what we are trying to do in Worthing with our seaweed project is to try and turn around that relationship that people have here with seaweed and basically say, you know, first of all, it's a very nutritious food source for us, but it's also extremely vital for the marine wildlife, which is why, again, you know, I was saying don't take the whole lot out if you do try and eat some seaweed, because we need to keep seaweed in the water for marine wildlife and actually also to produce oxygen for the whole planet. And on the other hand, so you've got like changing the relationship that people have with seaweed. And on the other hand, you know, talk to your water company and ask them about how they make sure that they don't release raw sewage into the sea, that they make sure that they clear up all of the stuff that does go into the sea before, you know, so that the big pollutants don't go into the seawater. And the other thing that we're at the moment doing is working with the Environment Agency to find out what actual pollutants are in the water and how safe it could potentially be to eat seaweed in Sussex.
That's Anne Thwaites there on pretty much a one-woman mission to bring seaweed to everybody's table. But how incredible that it could be potentially a plastic alternative. I'm really excited to see what happens with that and learn more about that. She is currently running a project called Neptune's Larder, if you're anywhere in and around Worthing in East Sussex. But you can find out more about her stuff. I will put links up, actually, on the show page. If you go to radioreverb.com/show, search for Growing Wild. I'm going to stick up loads of links on there so that anything you're interested in, hopefully you can click and find it there. And finally, we come to Ella Foote. Now, she is just actually coming to the end of something that she has done for the last 3 years called Dip a Day December. She's a very keen outdoor swimmer and she writes about it and she makes these great, she's great on social media for this. Her Instagram stories are really funny. You sort of see the progression of tiredness through this month of December, where she's got up every single day, swum with somebody different in somewhere different, just to raise charity for Mind. I think she's just brilliant. So I know she wasn't on that long ago, and that was a little bit of a factor for why some people haven't been on this show. If they were on really recently, then unfortunately they didn't make the list. But Ella was on just a couple of shows back, and her ethos I really enjoyed as well, with just sort of just following your curiosity and where that takes you. And I thought that was a nice ethos to end on. So here is a mini version of my interview with Ella when we had a swim in the sea and then came out and sat on the beach and had this chat.
One of the things I enjoy is the feeling of the water, and it doesn't matter what body of water you're in, it's always going to be different. The silt, the salty or the brininess of an estuary, or, you know, I'd say it sometimes that the Thames is kind of silky because of the silt and stuff. I like being in just my cozy. And then just kind of I got into that addiction of like wanting to do colder, further, longer. And I was never fast, ever. But that was okay. I'm a strong swimmer now. I'm really confident and comfortable with my stroke. I've worked a lot on it. See, the more I do and the more experience I get, the more I can kind of map out my own swims and do my own things, which is great. Because the events do come with a big price tag.
They are expensive.
They're really expensive. Yeah.
And it does change, it changes the experience of being in the water.
Absolutely.
It becomes more about getting from one place to another and not about just enjoying being in water. And I think more than any other thing, the experience of being sort of held by the water and being in the water is quite a special feeling. It's not, and sometimes you get it with running, but it's quite
fleeting.
Very fleeting. Like, oh, was that what they talk about? That nice feeling when you run. But it isn't, it's not really about that so much, but there's something, it's quite elemental.
Yeah, no, that is a really nice way of putting it. And I think I was getting to the point where I'd go to the lake or I'd go down to the river and I'd feel like I was having to do, I should probably knock out a couple of kilometres, otherwise what's the point? And I felt like I couldn't just go and lark about and then get out and eat a bit of cake. I felt like I had to be doing something, and I almost lost my mojo a little bit as well. And then I started sort of doing my own personal sort of projects. Like, you know, a couple of years ago, I started doing swimming every single day of December.
Yes.
Dipper day December. Yeah. Because I'm not very good in the darker months. I'm an outdoor person. You know, I love the beauty of the longer days that daylight saving gives us in the summer. So it was forcing me to get outside, so to make a commitment. The first couple of days I was like, what the hell am I doing, this is hideous. And then, you know, sort of probably by the end of that week, I really started to feel the benefit and like that sense of accomplishment. Like, I'd get to work, I'd be like, yeah, I've already done a proper swim this morning. You know, winter can be quite isolating. You know, we're more social in summer in the sense that, you know, we'll be like, let's pop to the pub for a couple of drinks, or it's a nice day, let's go for a walk and all that kind of thing. And suddenly when winter comes, everyone hunkers down and starts watching Strictly Come Dancing, and it can be a very isolating time. And actually forcing myself outside every day and then talking about it actually forced me to socialise with other people as well.
Have you progressively gotten more adventurous? Has it led you
definitely
to be a more adventurous person?
Yeah.
100%.
I wasn't a girl guide. I didn't do any of that when I was younger. I did ballet lessons instead of that. I wasn't, you know, I didn't do the Duke of Edinburgh or anything like that. I really wasn't an outdoorsy person. I mean, ask my parents, they'd be like, you used to moan about going for a walk. And now I'm taking them for a walk, saying, there's this great waterfall up here. It's only another half an hour.
With your writing, do you use that as your tool to encourage other people to get involved? Do you feel like that's almost how you can contribute? Because I know with this, I started making this because I felt like I'd found something that made me feel so alive and really connected by being outside, in the way that you can engage with so many different things and what that brings to you. I was like, I just want to see if I can spread the word a little bit. It's a bit evangelical, actually.
Yeah, spread the message.
So that was a huge reason why I started doing this, and it's interesting to understand other people's drive for why they do it.
Especially
when you don't know much.
Yeah, I love people's stories and storytelling. So, you know, the more I swam, the more incredible people I met, either doing incredible things, like the chap who's just about to finish swimming around the entire coast of Britain.
And his tongue melted.
Yeah, you know, people like that. Or just the people who get up every day and just quietly swim, you know, and you sort of see them. Like, we've seen a couple of people here today.
Yeah.
On the beach, just sort of quietly getting on with it. You know, the range is huge, and everyone has a very unique and special story, and I love telling those stories through my writing. Someone said the other day, just follow the crumbs and you'll be okay, and I found something I love, which is swimming. You know, I went to university, I did a writing and media degree, you know, and then I've just made it work, and I'm by no means
doing financially well, but I am so happy, and it's the happiest I've been in a really long time, and my life is a lot richer for it, just for following the crumbs.
That was Ella Foot there. So we've come to the end of the show and to the end of the year. I just want to say thank you to everybody that's been on this year. It's a pleasure always to meet you. And to those of you who have listened, thank you very much. It's nice to know that I have your ears. And I should share with you actually that I was fortunate and very pleased to win another award this year, and it was for Radio Broadcast of the Year with the Garden Media Guild Awards. So that was a lovely ending of the year for me. Thank you. The show that won was actually the Wellbeing Show, which the Dementia Group, who I played earlier, featured on, and alongside Grow and the Lemon Tree Trust, all three very excellent causes. So if you'd like to catch up with that, then like I said earlier in the show, all of these podcasts, all of the shows are available via the Radio Reverb website or on iTunes. I wish you a happy new year, and I will be back in January with fresh voices and lots of interesting people doing interesting things. So thank you again for listening. I'm going to play you out with Carly Bryant, who is my best friend, and she's very talented. So I'm going to play her song, and it's called Help. Go well. I could scare.